Hello, and welcome to Temporal Culture War, where we dig into what the hell was going on in America in the early 2000s while we watch one of television history's most maligned properties, Star Trek Enterprise. I'm Maddie Lipchansky.
I am Clayton Ashley.
And this week, it is episode 7 of season 1, The Andorian Incident. And the week of October 31st, 2001, we are also joined today by our first guest, Enterprise Lover, and also cocktail expert, podcaster, author, master seamstress, all-around yes. angel, John DeBerry. Hello, John.
Hi.
Welcome.
I'm so honored to be here.
Oh my God, thank you for coming on.
I feel like I'm kind of the father of this podcast. In a weird
a little bit.
When I was
getting through my big Star Trek rewatch of all the treks I did earlier this year, I think it was earlier. I was sort of like in an insanity hole.
Yeah.
Working on a book, and you were the only person that told me Enterprise was worth watching. Everybody else was like, skip it. And you were like, no, it's actually good. Which
here we are.
Has not borne out yet. I have seen it all the way through. And there is good stuff, but it is, I would like to say, in general, later.
So yeah.
Early in the doldrums in season one here.
Neither of us remembered how bad the first season was.
Yes, really.
I don't think I even watched it when it was on.
Yeah. I watched the first season of this show like 6 months ago and I forgot how bad it is.
Exactly. Yeah. Same.
John, what is your relationship to the show, Star Trek Enterprise, or as it was known while airing, simply
Enterprise?
Yeah.
Well, I grew up watching Star Trek with my parents. Very cute. And like Wednesday night was like Voyager with my mom. She loved Neelix.
Who doesn't love Neelix?
Who doesn't love Neelix?
I love Neelix.
Yeah. And then Enterprise started in like September of 2001. And that was also my first week of college.
Oh.
And so I kind of like didn't really have much in the way of interest in watching Star Trek. I think I maybe downloaded a couple episodes here and there. But like Wednesday, 8 p.m., I was not watching TV. So
yeah, you were busy attending World Trade Center University.
Yes. I mean, I was in Columbia. So
okay, that's close enough.
Yeah.
So here we first, before we talk about the episode.
We'll get to it.
We like to talk a little bit about what was going on in America this week of Halloween, spooky, 2001. I was casting around for like news events and actually very little happened this week. Like the Enron scandal was kind of chugging along.
Yeah, we've discussed it already.
It was my 19th birthday.
That was your
19th.
Oh, okay. Happy birthday back then.
It's not on Wikipedia, but we'll fix that.
I'll get on it.
Yeah.
You should. Listeners, get on it. Add it to the October 2001 Wikipedia page. John DeBerry's 19th birthday. The one thing that actually John mentioned right before we hopped on was this was when they found all the gold at the World Trade Center.
Okay, you're going to have to fill me in on this because I do not understand much of the story.
So there was like a bank in the Trade Center, and what was the name of the bank again? It was Nova Scotia?
Something like that.
Yeah. The Bank of Nova Scotia's vault
yes.
was in the rubble of the buildings, and and that's when they finally located all the gold that they had to find. I was doing research for my other podcast, No Gods, No Mares. And I was talking about Rudy Giuliani. And one of his big points of contention with the NY Fire Department, the New York Fire Department, was that he stopped looking for bodies after they located the gold. And I were encountering that sentence like, that's wild to consider. But there was gold and they did have to find it, and they did find it.
This sounds like the worst entry in the National Treasure franchise.
Yeah, digging through skeletons to find the Nova Scotia gold.
Was the gold like solid? Was it melted? Like what was the format?
It was in the vault, so I assume it was fine.
Yeah.
Because, you know, jet fuel can't melt vaults, as we all know.
No. It would very easily melt gold, though, because this has a very low melting
temperature. I wonder if the vault was just full of melted and reformed gold.
The elephant's foot.
It was just in the shape of the inside of the vault.
Maybe. I'm doing like an image search of the gold they found.
It sounds like a made-up story. Like
it looks like it stayed in bars.
Huh.
That's crazy. I got nothing to add to that one.
It's just a strange artifact of October 2001.
So very little news, but we can move on to culture. culture stuff. Looking at the music charts for this week, rocketing to the top is Mary J. Blige's Family Affair. A good song. I think we're fine. There's not, again, we're not yet like in the cursed zone here. That finally took over from J-Lo's I'm Real, another good song. But coming in fast is Enrique Iglesias' Hero and Michelle Branch's Everywhere, which is a sort of different kind of aesthetic, is like the long 90s chug to a close. Hanging tough, Lee Greenwood's God Bless the USA is still hanging around. That song, that the really accursed, you know, I'm proud to be an American because at least I know I'm free.
What did it rank as? How high?
Mr. Lee Greenwood was at number 37. Down from its peak at 16, but at 6 weeks on the chart. Okay. So he's moving up. He was at 84 last week. He's back to 37. So the song's got some real staying power, as people love to think about how they're Americans and they're free.
It couldn't compare to Whitney Houston, which she actually got on the top 10, right? With that Star Spangled Banner.
I believe she did, which is where is she this week? The Star Spangled Banner by Whitney Houston has dropped to number 18.
It probably had some special event thing tied to it. I don't know.
Yeah, barely edging Drops of Jupiter by Train. This is a wonderful week. Also shooting up the chart at number 45, Pink's Get the Party Started. And now we're talking really cursed culture, I think, kind of setting in finally.
What there was someone I feel like we talked about last time.
Yeah.
That was also just like starting to inch up a very
was that Blue Cantrell?
I think it was Nickelback.
It was Nickelback. Oh yeah, how's Nickelback doing this week? How do you remind me? Yeah, creeping up number 17.
I actually, just because I was so curious about it, I looked ahead. Yeah. And just keep a look on that one.
Okay, look, Nickelback watches in effect.
Nickelback
watch this space
for more Nickelback news.
Not Nickelback warning yet.
Yeah. Also here, Brooks and Dunn.
Situations are favorable for Nickelback.
Yeah. Also creeping up. Only in America by Brooks and Dunn. People are really into songs about America and how good it is. Because of how good America is, a fact we all know and love.
That's why they hate us.
And that's why they hate us because of Lee Greenwood and his good song, God Bless the USA.
John, do you have any idea what you might have been listening to in this time?
I was listening to Bjork's Homogenic pretty much on repeat from like August 2001 to like maybe May 2002. So that's pretty much what was happening with me.
Yeah. the whole top 10 was just the track listing from Homogenic.
Yeah, pretty much.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful to consider.
I saw her at Radio City Music Hall in like October of that year, actually.
I'm shocked that they went through with that, because I feel like for a long time, a lot of big concerts and stuff were off.
Yeah, I also saw Travis there, and Travis was like, oh, we're like really sorry for you guys, like it really sucks, but like here's some music, and we're cool, thanks.
I remember that fall going to see Bat Boy the Musical, an off-Broadway show, which was based on the, you know, like the tabloid news story about the Bat Boy. It was like during this wave of like ironic off-Broadway musicals, like You're in Town, Bat Boy, this kind of thing. It was like there's a whole wave of these musicals that were very like, we're poking fun at the fact that we're a musical while we're a musical, kind of like echoes of Little Shop of Horrors, but like less good. But Bat Boy, we saw Bat Boy that fall, and the whole cast came out afterwards, like on stage crying about how happy they were. People actually came to a Broadway show.
Oh no.
So I think it's actually shocking that people were doing like big, that Travis and Bjork were still rolling through town with the fear everywhere. So brave of them. This week at the movies, we got some new ones. Topping the box office is Monsters, Inc., new this week.
Oh,
wow.
A movie I had nothing interesting to say about. Pretty good. Back when Pixar couldn't miss. I don't know.
Yeah.
Monsters, Inc. That was a movie that they probably started making in 1997. So it's got very little 9/11-ness to it.
I feel like it had one of the most charming credit sequences where they did fake bloopers. I remember
that. Oh, yeah. That was good. That was good. Yeah. Billy Crystal, who we all loved then. And you could not kill him. The Jet Li's The One is at number two. Oh. A movie that I forgot existed.
Is it the multiverse one?
It's the multiverse one, which I was reading the Wikipedia. I never saw. It's Jet Li.
And it had Aaliyah in it?
Aaliyah was... No, I'm not seeing Aaliyah. I think you might be thinking of Queen of the Night.
Well, there's that. I wouldn't... Yeah.
Is there another Aaliyah movie?
Well, there's Try Again, the song that she has, and he's in it. The video.
Really?
Huh. I think, right? She's like doing some kind of like martial arts. Maybe okay. I'm completely.
How often? Oh, Romeo Must Die is what you're thinking.
That's it. Okay.
Yeah. Right. It's also 2001.
This one's that Anthony Hopkins movie we talked about a couple episodes ago as being a movie I totally was aware existed based surely on seeing the poster and like Blockbuster constantly or like the DVD sitting there. Never seen it. Didn't really know what it was about.
Hearts in Atlantis is the name of that film.
That's the one.
Yeah. So there's the one I remember seeing a lot of like VHS covers where I was reading the Wikipedia plot summary. And there's some really incredible stuff here. It keeps referring to something called the Stygian penal colony in the Hades universe, in which there is a big ziggurat. It seems like a movie where that exists, and also someone works as a sheriff in the LA County Sheriff's Department. Huh. So it's a lot of settings in this movie. The Hearts in Atlantis Award for a movie that exists goes to, coming at number three new this week, Domestic Disturbance.
Hmm.
A movie I've never heard of, but I looked up, and it is John Travolta and his ex-wife, Terry Polo, like the girl from Meet the Parents, marries Vince Vaughn, who then kills Steve Buscemi in front of their kid. And he's got to get like revenge on the new stepdad. And it looks like Death Wish for divorced guys. The both of you are just making a very
shocking. Both of us are just stunned by the
This movie made $50 million, I think, something like that. Yeah, like it made $45 million, $54 million worldwide. Off of this movie cost $75 million to make it. It doesn't look like it.
I already forgot what it's called. What is it called? It's called
Domestic Disturbance. And it's got a really upsetting poster with John Travolta and a knife.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah. So those three new ones edge out our champions from last week, K-Pax and 13 Ghosts.
Oh, K-Pax.
Wow. Oh, and don't forget, because I finally have a report on a movie we've discovered this way. I watched The Last Castle.
Oh, yeah.
With Robert Redford, James Gandolfini, Mark
Ruffalo.
It looked
like it rocked ass, yeah.
It really did. It was a solid prison caper where like they're former soldiers and they figure out, they lean into the Last Castle thing way more than I expected because they're, by the end of it, constructing trebuchets and catapults and stuff, and it's sick.
James Gandolfini very rarely around catapults in his career. So that's
and
nice
then,
to hear.
I went and read the reviews for it because I'm like, man, this rocked. Why did no one talk about it? And I could see the fact that it's kind of like not the most positive depiction of the American military. And so no one was in the mood for it around then. But the critics were very like, meh about it. I'm like, you had no idea how good you had it.
Yeah, really? Like, Domestic Disturbance looked like a real turd. But it seemed like a movie we don't get. A thriller. It's just normal. Also new this week, Coen Brothers, Man Who Wasn't There, an actually good movie. And of course, Jean-Pierre Jeunet's long-awaited follow-up to Alien Resurrection, Amelie, is here at number 29. Amelie, just fine to me, but, you know, obviously very important for college dorm rooms in the future.
Right.
I prefer Jean-Pierre Jeunet's insane French, City of Lost Children and Alien Resurrection, which are bug nuts insane movies that involve Brad Dourif kissing an alien on the mouth.
Is that a better filmography whiplash than Mad Max to Babe?
To Babe.
Well, to Happy Feet than back to Mad Max.
Crucially, George Miller did not direct Babe. He produced Babe and then... But mostly he was very hands-on and felt as if he was the real director of the movie. So when that movie got all these accolades, George Miller was like, fuck you, I'm directing Babe 2 myself. I want the credit. And then he made Babe 2, a movie I actually unironically love.
It's great. I only saw it recently.
It has the same exact climax as Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. It's got the same it's the same exact fight. Which is cool. But yeah, that's the week in culture. There's not a ton going on. It's kind of a quiet week. I guess everyone was kind of just wanted to have a nice Halloween where they dress up like Osama bin Laden, I guess. But I wanted to give us some more time to talk episode because we have a guest. And also it is Shran time.
Yeah. I guess this is the last chance for anything non-Star Trek. Was there anything else you can remember about this time?
2001 October? No. Does anyone remember their Halloween costume from this time?
I don't think I did Halloween that year.
You didn't do Halloween that year?
I don't know. I don't remember.
Yeah, that's a good point. We may have been kept inside.
I think I remember having like a weird sort of like truncated Halloween party at my friend's house. I was about to turn 16 And I think we were all just sort of like, are we doing Halloween this year? Or are we all supposed to like sit around being depressed still because of 9/11 happening?
And I think that's what they're putting in the candy now. I mean,
I think the candy scare that year must have been definitely, we were all watching out for anthrax in our candy apples and our Snickers bars, things of that nature.
But if we were fortunate enough to turn on an episode of Enterprise,
yeah,
you were actually rewarded with a good hour of television.
A treat.
Which is astounding to say on this podcast, because even the one we kind of liked was still a deeply flawed episode.
Which one was that?
The Impreg episode.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. The Impreg episode, pretty good, but also not a good episode of TV.
Yeah.
It's fun. It's got Impreg.
Path breaking.
Yeah. But yeah, a good episode of TV that I enjoyed, but also because my personal blurbo, you know, Jeffrey Combs is here, who I love so much.
I love him too.
As a Deep Space Nine freak.
This is a Jeffrey Combs thirst account for sure.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Cast just all in.
Yeah.
And remind people who he played in Deep Space Nine.
He was Weyoun. He was every Weyoun.
Every Weyoun.
Brunt.
He was also Brunt.
And I think arguably here, Eshran is his best role.
I mean, it's tough to say.
It's just because he shines so much in this. So we'll get started. Yeah. We start on a Vulcan planet.
I'm sorry, he isn't Voyager. He plays a guy named Pank.
Pank.
He's Pank, he's Shran, he's Brunt. What a career.
We begin right in situ. We are on a vaguely Eastern planet that is Vulcan. They definitely lean into the spiritualness of the Vulcans of this one.
Yeah, there's definitely just like straight up the Buddhist temple bell at this temple.
Yeah.
Like one-to-one.
And like the folding screen with like the circle in it.
Oh, yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or it's sort of a space China.
Yeah, not the greatest font of creativity right off the bat.
They got a whole word for this kind of thing.
Immediately though, this is a very quick intro scene because Shran and his posse show up. And again, we've mentioned the costume, like how they have aliens on this show, but they look good. And I read the 25 year, the 50 year journey. And I remember them talking a lot about the fact that they went for it with these antenna and actually made them like robotically controlled by a person who's off in the set with like a game controller kind of, or like a remote control, manipulating them so they can kind of have some sort of like emotional reaction to what's going on and not just sort of randomly.
The best job.
Can you imagine?
Is awesome to think of.
Yeah. I love at the
antenna operator
at the Museum of the Moving Image. They've here in beautiful Queens, at the Henson exhibit, they've got all the, like the showing, like the kind of like servo motor puppet stuff that they were like working on in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And it's all, this is how they did the Doozers.
Oh.
It's the same thing. It's just like a cool remote. And yeah, dream job to operate the antennas off screen.
Do you think it was like a Dreamcast controller, like a DualShock?
Because
they've got the antenna, you know, the DualShock with the dual.
Yeah, it makes sense.
GameCube.
Honestly, it makes sense.
And that's, I mean, it was probably an RC controller because those are a lot more modular. But yeah. I'm going to imagine it was a Dreamcast controller because it's 2001.
Jeffrey Combs actually had in his forehead the little Dreamcast thing. That
the VMU?
The controller. Yeah, they put that in his head and that was controlling it. A lot of people don't know that.
And they also got black leather suits. It's also very of this era, I think, the costuming. But so we get after the music intro. Our crew is complaining about the Vulcans again. I mean, that's kind of this episode. It is complaining about Vulcans, but their star charts are missing something. They're pretty excited about that. I thought it might matter, but it doesn't really. They were just having a little convo about how those uptight Vulcans don't get everything right.
Yeah, well, the sort of like the theme of this episode is those goddamn Europeans,
yes,
hastily crossed out Vulcans are once again holding back our brave Americans, crossed out Starfleet officers or whatever. Not Starfleet, it's called Earth space. What do they call it?
Earth Defense Force? No.
No. No.
Because you're right.
That's too fascist.
Earth Command or something. Yeah.
Yeah, they're like not super clear on what they're calling it. It's just sort of like they're the Earth, the human spaceship boys.
I realize they keep saying we're a spaceship from Earth. And the Vulcans are like, they're an Earth spaceship. I don't know what to tell you.
But they're pretty hard on the old Vulcos in this episode.
They're like, hey, T'Pol, there's this planet. We want to visit it. Padumch. And they make clear that this is important to the Vulcans because it's where they go to religiously divest themselves of their
purge.
T'Pol's not into it at first. Doesn't want to bring all these humans to such an important Vulcan planet. But we get a quick scene with our man Phlox, just one little bit, where he reminds T'Pol of the old Vulcan saying, infinite diversity and infinite combinations.
That old saying that we all love to say. It's a very Phlox light episode for such a banger.
Yeah.
True.
Normally, there's like a direct correlation for me and like how much I'm enjoying the episode with how much Phlox is there.
Same.
And the other ones, he's like the buoyancy keeping the whole thing from drowning most of the time.
Yes. Very much so.
But here he's just a nice little treat added on to a very good episode.
That's right.
You know, we're after this scene, we're back to dealing with the Vulcans because we get some like, it's actually kind of like Peruvian flute, reminded me a little bit. Like,
yeah, a little bit. It's definitely like, it is definitely like a South American sounding flute for sure. Though I guess it's hard to have a flute that doesn't sound Peruvian.
Yeah.
It's doing like a pan flute.
And we get the first scene, and I think you really drilled down into it. It shows how this is a better episode generally, because T'Pol's already given the kind of like the lowdown about how this is going to go a very certain way. You got to do things a very certain way.
Yeah.
And they're probably going to tell you to leave. So
he's going to come out. Don't speak to him until he talks to you. And then you're going to ask him for a special rock. Like, and they're going to give you the special rock and then you leave, which I never quite, I don't
understand, because did you take the rock? Do they have an infinite supply of rocks?
They got a big pile of rocks back there that they're giving. It's like it's like getting one of those like squished pennies at the zoo. Like I gotta go to the Vulcan temple. I give them a dollar and one penny, and they give me a special penny that I then take back to my spaceship. Are other Vulcans doing this?
The name of the rock made it sound very singular. Like this was the only one.
Yes.
You're right. I guess they're just constantly handing them out. They're party favors. But this conversation, he says, you know, we're busy, go away. Basically, here's the stone.
The stone of Jaka.
And,
stupid,
you know,
stupid.
If we didn't know already what's going on here, you actually would be led on to believe that, oh, okay, this is what we expected to happen. It's just like, go away, they're uptight Vulcans, whatever. And that's how our humans sort of react. Oh, this is what we expected to happen. But it's T'Pol who's like, something's very strange here. He was agitated.
My man is pissed off.
Also, that one, that you see that vase over there?
It's like 30 degrees off kilter.
Vulcans only do this when they're in distress.
Yeah. That's the distress vase position.
But I kind of love that because it's like, really? He's agitated? Okay. And they decide to pull off a very typical plan of let's kind of agitate him more, keep pushing the limits of what we can do, act very human and annoying to figure out what's going on until they find a guy behind a sheath, like a sheath, and they do their action. They think they've got the upper hand, and then all the rest of the Andorians show up, and they're like, not so fast.
You know what I find interesting about the Jeffrey Combs reveal is that usually when people are like guest stars and they're going to be a big deal, there's always like a Star Trek shot where it's like, you know, like they right in their face and you're like, yes, this is the main character.
Yeah.
But you kind of don't get that with them. And all the other ones are all there too. And it just feels like they're just throwing him in as like almost an extra. And I really wanted a grander entrance for Jeffrey Combs, but apparently that didn't happen.
For him to like emerge behind the screen, like full body like, shot.
I'm here. Yes.
Yeah. It's like, it's
and
me.
It pans up.
And Commander
it's like,
Shran. Yeah.
And I was thinking that first because I was like, oh man, I'm having a hard time telling these Andorians apart. Which
yeah, because it's hard to tell who's who. Yeah.
Oh, so you guys are racist against Andorians.
I know. I feel bad admitting that, but when your skin's blue, really, it's hard to tell.
They all do have almost exactly the same faces and
hair.
And hair.
And
why do they all have the same haircut?
They all have like weird pattern baldness.
Yeah.
Well, it's from the antennas, which makes
it's true.
I guess, yeah, they have to.
They're like here.
the antenna yeah. systems need energy in a 3-inch radius. So
I think they need servos is what they need, I think.
We also really only get one of them as a distinct character, I feel like, other than Shran.
Yeah.
Which I don't even think he gets named, but just kind of the creepy one.
He's so creepy.
He's awful to behold. I don't like his face. He's got a really, I'm looking at his face now, and it's just really, his forehead is,
there's a lot of it.
Severe.
It's a mess.
It's too much.
This is also where you start getting learn the fact that the Andorians are going to just refer to the humans as pinkskins, which, yeah, that tracks. That would be very weird to them.
Yeah, we're talking a lot about how blue they are.
Yeah. So.
It makes a lot of sense.
Is the fair about thing. Is fair play.
This is also a very Caucasian crew that came down. So
yeah, you notice all these humans have hair where their antennas should be. It's pretty crazy. Yeah.
And so they take them into where they're keeping all the other Vulcans hostage. The Andorians are very like mean and standoffish. Frankly, I like how much it's obvious. They even say it outright. They are the inverse of the Vulcans. They're suspicious and volatile instead of rational and thoughtful, I guess. Yeah.
And it's also funny because like T'Pol is like, oh, the Andorians hate us for our freedom.
Yeah.
Basically. Yeah. She's like, our technology is too good. We're too logical. Our swag too bad. You know, our bitch is too hot.
We're too hot.
They'll kill you, Vulcans. Yeah. Like it's
and they just never cared to tell the humans about the Andorians. Like massive antagonists for like centuries.
They're
just
like next door.
Need to know.
Yes, our next door neighbors
are very close.
Fighting with, don't worry about it.
It's all fine. Yeah, we're always they're sorry. Yeah, they're always doing a terrorist attack on our sort of monk, our monastery planet.
Main religious site.
It's like always they're like always showing up looking for arrays of various sensors. And they're always coming as terrorists, and they leave after a little bit. And it's like, whatever. It's not a big deal.
It's a thing. It's, you know, don't worry about it.
I mean, I guess it tracks with the general Vulcan attitude, which is like treating the humans like children, like a European would.
Yeah. And are these like the hot-headed Eastern Europeans? I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I guess on some level, they're sort of like very like USSR coded.
Russians.
Yeah.
A little bit.
It's cold.
Yeah.
It's cold. They're paranoid.
Your technology's not quite as good.
I personally think they're very cool. Mm-hmm. It's all tracks.
Yeah.
Can we also talk about how this episode was directed by Blanca Torres?
Please do. I actually.
That's it. That's all I got. Yeah, she directed. This is her first episode that she directed of Enterprise, and she directed a bunch. Yeah. She also did. She's directed so much television; it's out of control. And whenever I see her, I'm like, it's gonna be a good one. Huh. So I credit her with the reason why this episode is so great because they finally brought her on.
Big up to Blanca Torres.
Yeah.
Yeah. There is good directing in it. Like, I think this is part of it, that it's also cohesive.
Yeah.
That's a good director's hand.
Yep.
Yeah. I feel like the last episode we watched about the mud people who live under the planet
and eat
turtles. It was like one of the worst directed episodes of television I've ever noticed. Like I just, in a way, like, you know, normally television directing, especially at this time, was not a thing you noticed or cared about who was doing. Mm-hmm. You know, if you notice television directing it shows from this time, it means you're going to notice it being bad most of the time.
Right.
But yeah, I think this is like the camera movements and the shot composition in this episode is actually quite good.
Yeah. I have some picked out. I'm going to mention as we get to them.
Yeah.
And so that's the situation on the surface. Now we go back to Enterprise though. And up there, the crew is discussing what's going on. We actually do get an explanation for how bad a job Malcolm did at kind of knowing this was going to happen, because he's like, there's a ship right there. I should have checked for this. It's like, I mean, yeah, you should have. That's your job.
Probably.
But I really like this scene mostly because, oh, I'm forgetting her name, our communications officer.
Sato Hoshi.
Sato is saying this like thing about how I'll bet that right now they're figuring out what's going on. They're probably doing, a meditation ritual. Bam, straight into a first person punch. And I yelped at that. I loved that like transition. Beautiful stuff.
It's really good.
Because Archer's getting interrogated. This is how a hot-headed alien race would do interrogations. Just a lot of punching. And I like how he does not believe Archer when he says, we're just here to see the temple.
Yeah.
We're just idiots.
You keep saying like we're trying to get the rock. Like we're just here to get our souvenir penny and leave.
And Shran is also understandably like weirded out by the fact that this human ship of aliens he's never seen before have one Vulcan in the crew. Like that is a little odd. And the Vulcans can't really explain it very well either. So it's like this episode could have been done badly. We've seen how often they do that in these episodes, but here they realized that the tensions going on with what's going on with this crew that has a history even can be used to make the show better as opposed to just make you confused all the time.
Yeah. Like Shran is like, what is she doing there? And like, well, she was assigned to our ship and he's like, oh, you take orders from the high command. Like it's like a real actual ratcheting up of tension in a way that tracks with everything we've seen already.
And then to interrupt it, we get one of the Enterprise's communicators going off and he's like, they're calling me. And so we get another one of my favorite things where Shran picks it up, answers, and basically just quickly says like, if you do anything, I'll kill them.
Yeah.
And then smashes it. And then methodically smashes each of the other ones. And it's like, this is his character. He just gets the thing done and he doesn't let anything sort of stop his action. And it's also just so much like character development without dialogue. What, you can do that?
A visual medium telling stories visually. It's interesting.
But we and then we get the kind of fun little thing, the Vulcans back in the room, to Poles talking to the priest. What are they talking about? How much humans smell.
She's like, you get used to it.
Yeah.
But she also has like a thing that she applies to her nose every day. So she's using this like
nasal
inhibitor.
She calls it a numbing agent.
A numbing agent.
She's getting a little sticks of vapor rug on there.
Yeah. Which implies that smell is a touch tactile sensation. Sense. Yeah. Which I don't necessarily think is right.
I don't. Well, maybe the Vulcans are different.
Yeah.
They just have little fingers in their noses.
Feeling the smells. Maybe that's why they smell so good. They're so good at smelling, is that they have little fingers in their nose, sort of wafting.
I think that's canon, actually.
I think it is now.
Yeah.
You have the two eyelids, and they have fingers in their nose.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But what's actually going on here is the Vulcans decide this is the point when they're going to reveal, oh, yeah, we got a trapdoor in our temple. Goes down to the catacombs. By the way, we've got catacombs. Did you know that?
Yeah.
That might be useful, but...
for getting out of this like hostage situation.
and the Andorians don't know about it. Yeah, it might be useful. And which Tucker says, for people without emotions, you sure have a flair for the dramatic.
Yeah.
Good line.
That's such a read. It's so accurate.
The library is open. The
library is open.
That's
so again. We have a catacomb now. It's full of Vulcan mummies. This rocks.
Like the Vulcan mummy, I thought looked very cool, and I was very into it.
It went hard, yeah.
And they're down there, like searching. We have more tension because we don't want the Andorians to realize they're gone. And they get back just in time after the little sort of scouting mission. Where I feel like the only thing that's kind of important here, even though it's sort of like an aside, is there's a refectory, the place
where a reliquary
where the real holy shit is, I guess. And we don't go down there. No one goes down there. Don't think about it. Yeah. Don't think about the thing I just told you to think about.
Don't worry about it.
Anyway,
yeah.
They have now a plan, or at least Archer is kind of like trying to convince them. It's a poll. Let's you know, fight our way out of this. We have like a element of surprise now. We can stop this instead of just letting the Andorians walk all over you. T'Pol is also kind of like giving her view of how we don't solve violence with violence. But in the midst of this, I feel like there's this weird thing where he convinces her to get in the blanket with him.
Yeah, this feels like an intervention. I feel like this is a good episode because there's very few interventions from what I've been calling the Chad Truck effect. Chad, is that what we're calling him?
We can do that.
Mr. Truck is a resident of Centralia, Kansas, who the network is trying very badly to impress. And that's why they're wearing boiler suits and are all Republicans, you know? And that's why this is like Star Trek that's like for tough guys. And I think this is like every so often the specter of Mr. Truck looms large in the network's imagination. You have to do something like, we have to like sexually humiliate the actress that plays T'Pol now for a couple of minutes.
It's baffling in like She says, I guess, biologically, she doesn't need it. But he's so insistent in a way that I don't know why it convinces her. It's like the weakest writing, but yeah, I think you have.
And also, you smell bad. Get That's in.
Good. Yeah. Yeah. Like, get under the sweat blanket with me. Like, mm-hmm. okay. And I think also at this point, I wrote down you people. One of them says you people. I think he says you people to her about Vulcans, but
yeah.
So we also get, for Chad Trucker, we get a little more racism in here.
Good. Great.
But as awkward as this is, it ends in a note where he's basically trying to get around the fact he wants to question her loyalty. He's like, are you really going to follow me when push comes to shove? Are you going to be with your Vulcan pals? And she points out, I have literally never disobeyed you. Okay, we're like about 7 episodes in. They have a history now, and that's helping this a lot. So that hits in a way that, like, you know, probably wouldn't have after 1 episode.
Yeah.
But what we understand is that they have figured out that there are some lights coming down in the catacombs. And another fun scene where we know what it is because they do another fun transition, kind of from the lights to the big face sculpture thing that's in there where the Andorians are held up. But I kind of liked how I didn't understand exactly what Archer's plan was. It's like, is he going to fight them? And like,
I liked hearing about the humans in Canton, Ohio and their historic facts.
It was bizarre. And it confused me as much as it confused the Andorians.
Yeah.
But then we get another little scene with our friends up on the Enterprise. We get a ton of consternation about the teleporter because they have to, like, they can't just have a teleporter on the show, even though this episode, I think, proves how much they really want it to make it feel Star Trek-y. So they lead with Sato on the controls, like, is very afraid of it. And that's actually good foreshadowing. She has a whole episode about that. But one of the security guards on Malcolm's team is also, like, wary of it. And Malcolm himself is just like, we got to do it. It's the only way.
Because it kills you?
Because it copies you? It kills you. There's no other way that it would work.
It's Although, not... in TNG Season 6, Episode 2, Realm of Fear, you do see a first-person POV of going through the transporter, and there is a continuity of consciousness, so...
Yeah, okay, that clearly was there to make people feel better about the fact that it fucking kills you.
It feels really good while you die, though.
it feels like you're getting sucked off to death every time.
I saw somebody trying to defend this by saying that, well, when you fall asleep and wake up again, somebody could argue that your consciousness died and a new one is born.
I fucking guess so.
That's not true. But you're also materially the same thing.
Yeah. That's the thing. That is the difference.
Yeah, that one, you fall asleep is like some real, like, do you think the color blue that I see is the same color blue that you see? It's like really just asinine. That's teleporter apologia, probably from someone who works for big teleporter. Thank you.
I think
absolutely.
Star Trek is truly cosmic horror the whole time. They're all constantly dying and being reborn.
Yeah,
we'll just move on with it. Just live your life.
It's fine.
Very brief between teleportations. So they get down there. Once again, kind of not sure what their plan is. I kind of like how little they've set up front exactly what they're going to try to do here, because you hear the teleportation. The Andorians are like, there's an energy signal. What's going on? They rush back into the room and nothing's happened because the idea was to teleport them and then quickly move them into the tunnels.
Yeah.
So we still have the tension of not quite knowing where it's going. And it turns out that makes it more exciting to watch an hour of television.
That's crazy.
This is where we get creepy Andorian.
His name is Tholos.
Tholos.
Tholos. And he's played by a man named Steven Dennis, who also played the alien that looks like poop in that one episode of Voyager. there's an alien that looks like poop.
Is it listed like that on IMDb?
He's called the Night Alien, if I recall correctly.
The Nightshade.
From the episode of Voyager called Night, where there's like an alien that is, he looks like poop. I don't know how else to tell you. I'm gonna drop it in the chat, and you guys are gonna be like, check him out. Look at him.
Oh yeah,
he looked like poop. He's a poop looking guy. So this actor can only play aliens that are horrible to look at and that I don't want to look at.
Yeah, I'm surprised how little you notice the forehead in the poop alien, though.
Yeah, I mean, I think the actor is a normal. You know what?
No, his forehead's quite prominent.
It's quite. Yeah, it kind of looks like somebody inflated John Mulaney's head a little bit.
Yeah. It's like a little bit of a DreamWorks vibe, you know, like this.
Oh, a little Megamindy.
Yeah, exactly.
Sure. Not to be so mean to this actor, Steven Dennis.
He's
quite handsome.
Yeah, yeah, and I wish I could say I was an Andorian. That'd be cool. He intimidates T'Pol. Again, it's very creepy, but the line he goes with is, "I hear that you make your men fight each other to the death. Would you like me to kill someone for you?"
It's pretty hot.
Yeah, it's pretty good creepy writing for what's going on here.
Yeah.
And then when Archer comes back,
at least he's asking for consent.
Yeah.
Getting enthusiastic consent to kill somebody in a hot way for me.
Yeah. Archer starts to get mad about this, and he's like, "What about him?" And then around this time, the mask in that we saw is the tunnel into the Andorian room. They put some explosives on it, the crew from the Enterprise, and they blow it up. One of the Andorians gets stunned immediately, but she can't get Shran that easily. He hightails it out of there. And then the Enterprise crew, they end up in the room with the rest of the hostages, help Archer to take out Andorian the creep. Tholos. Try to name him by his actual character name.
Yeah.
His Christian name. And I guess there's another character on this show that I this is where I started naming him in the notes. He's a intense youth Vulcan.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, him.
He's kind of like the priest's right-hand dude.
Yes.
And you just kind of think he's intense because some Vulcans are like this. He's got a bit of more of a Zachary Quinto vibe than like a elderly Vulcan vibe.
Yes.
The priest is mad about what's happening, but they're like, "We got to go down there." They're heading down into the catacombs. And this is when intense youth Vulcan grabs a gun and is like, I'm ready to start fighting. Or at least, you know, that's what they're implying. It's like, he's finally going to stand up for himself and not just get all walked over like a typical a Vulcan.
Yeah.
And then we get laser tag in the reliquary.
Yeah. It is basically that. And that's when they find the door in the reliquary, right? When they're shooting at each other.
Exactly. It's I remember the first time I watched this episode and I loved this twist at the end.
I was legitimately kind of surprised.
Like, it actually caught me off guard and was like a really good resolution to what was going on here and the point of the episode.
Yeah.
Which is that, oh, lo and behold, there is a Vulcan secret listening base. And apparently no one inside this base heard any of the laser shooting outdoors because no one is paying attention. It's very strange.
They're just like, oh, hey.
It's a big door.
We're just chilling in the Moonraker set.
That we had the underground Moonraker that we got going here. A very cool thing here, like reading the memory alpha for the episode. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite things that happens on fandom Wikipedia pages, which is, it says here, they spare a statue of what looks like a horse. And then there's a link to horse and you can read the Star Wars.
Oh yes.
The Star Trek. Wow. The Star Trek entry for horse.
For horse.
Which was a large herbivorous terrestrial mammal native to Earth. And then there's a picture of a guy on a horse and it says a horse being ridden by a human male, which I just think is fun.
Someone decided that needed to be done and they did it.
And they've got every appearance by a horse on every Star Trek.
That's the best part, is that the historical record is there. I was hopeful there might be like one weird thing in there. Because I know if you go to the page for whales on Star Trek, you're going to find some actual fiction there. But this is just what a horse is.
There's no horse-powered spaceship that we know of.
That we know.
Sorry to interrupt with horse facts.
Thinking
about it.
We get the secret listening base. This is when it turns out, intense youth Vulcan knew it was happening and wanted to protect this. Again, love the fact that we thought he was trying to do one thing. It turns out he's just a shitty little security officer trying to keep this secret.
Yeah, he's in the Vulcan CIA.
I guess it's not specifically established, but what he actually cares about is not the religion. He cares about keeping this a secret. I don't know if he's actually part of it or whatnot, but because he sucks as a security officer. He's like barely holding the gun. He's like, don't make me use this. I've shown throughout this episode, I don't care about standing up for myself, but I'm definitely going to do it now. And Archer is able to just like turn around and grab the gun. It's not hard at all.
Yeah.
And then Archer, like, I guess he's testing T'Pol because he's like, to pull, scan this place, and then hand the data to one of your enemies.
Yeah, like she's a golden retriever or something.
Like
as if she was personally responsible for this whole deception.
Yeah.
It's I saw Vulcans behaving badly, so I'm racistly mad at my friend.
And just to make sure you're not like them.
Yeah.
You're one of the good ones.
You're one of the good ones.
And then, you know, Shran says, you're in my debt. And he leaves. He tells the Enterprise, like, by the way, the Andorians are leaving and you got to let them. So that resolves the episode. It pretty much ends right there.
Yeah. But Shran and Archer have their first, like, I'm going to have like a grudging hate, but also I like you kind of relationship.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I just love.
There's definitely a vibe.
I love the way the two of them look at each other.
Yeah.
At the end.
They have a good rapport.
Yeah, it's really good.
I also remember in the book, Combs saying how nice
Scott Bakula.
Bakula is, like, how just total stand-up, super sweetie, just there to make sure everything's, like, happening on time. And
that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Mm.
But I also remember last night, right after this ended, I immediately went to look when the next Ran episode was, and it's 7 episodes away.
Oh. Reset the big Shran counter.
Exactly. I was like, this can sustain me. Can it sustain me for, you know, 6 non-Shran episodes?
Yeah.
Maybe.
Maybe. Oh, I'm looking at the next episode. I don't know.
It's bad. I watched it.
Oh, it's a bad one coming up. Great. Anyways.
Yeah, there's nothing to say.
I feel like we're finally fed a little bit by some Shran, like some crumbs of like a good character on the show and like also, a good episode.
I guess we didn't mention this up top, but like the Andorians were a thing that were in the original series.
Yes.
And then from what I understand, never again.
Nope.
There is an Andorian in Discovery, isn't there? Or I'm sorry. The other one. The fun first... Nope. The fun one. What's the good one that is fun? Strange New Worlds.
Oh.
There is an Andorian.
The engineer.
Oh, yeah.
The blind one.
Yeah. Wow. Who kicks ass. It is the kind of Andorian that is blind and has like psychic powers.
Right.
So because the Andorians, especially when Enterprise came out, had just never been touched upon again, but were actually a fairly frequent like background alien species and sometimes character in the original series.
They're one of the founding races of the Federation,
which the show will eventually get to.
Yes.
But here it's a thing that that book I mentioned reading, the 50 Year Journey, a consistent theme was how much that mainly Brannon, but also kind of Braga, didn't want to make this a prequel show by referencing things like the Andorians and the like writing crew. And I think maybe this was where Brannon was also like on their side, at least a little bit, was like, please let us do something like this. And this episode shows you like, this could have been a pretty rad show if they'd been allowed to do that more.
Yeah. I mean, and it's like, I hate when things kind of succumb to like prequelitis and just spend all this time like filling in lore or whatever. But this is the exact kind of right opportunity where it is something that's kind of underexplored in the lore. That is like a race that you know is around that humans are aware of. So there's like something to be done.
They had some integral thing to do with the Starfleet, and they also here give them a reason to be there, which is how much they are a part of the Vulcans' history.
Right.
As these kind of like
evidently
universe. Yeah.
As the number one haters.
Right. And they're right.
Maybe the number two haters. Yeah, the fact that the fact that they're right kicks ass, I think. And it makes the episode work in a way that if they were not right, it would be kind of boring.
And I guess, like, again, to tease people, this specific part of the Andorian Vulcan like story comes back pretty much anytime Shran comes back. Like, it's cool that not only is he a returning character, but he's kind of the return of one of the few good stories most of the time, which is the Vulcans, maybe not all they're cracked up to be.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're kind of dicks.
I don't like them.
At least these vaguely European isolationists.
The Vulcans of the 23rd century or whatever kind of suck.
Yeah.
They get better. The show addresses how they're different later, you know?
Yeah, we even got some sort of hints of that here with what the purpose of this planet was, but we've been foreshadowing a lot. I think a thing we should, though, do is, John, we had a lovely time with you here. Is there anything you would like to plug that you're doing?
Oh, gosh. Well, I've written two cocktail books, so there's that.
They're very good.
Drink What You Want is the first one, and then Saved by the Bellini is my 90s themed cocktail book. So go out and buy those.
Yeah. Very good. John also has a great newsletter.
I have a newsletter that publish sometimes on occasion.
Yeah. Find Mr. John DeBerry online and follow him and his great work and get the books because they're very good.
Your cocktail books reminded me of, isn't one of the things about Andorians is that they have Andorian ale or something? It's blue? Am I imagining this?
Probably.
Well, there's Romulan ale.
There's Romulan ale.
That's the blue.
Oh, yeah. That's the blue one. Damn.
And it's illegal. It's illegal in the Federation.
Probably made from Andorians.
No, Andorian ale is a blue ale.
Oh, there's also Andorians.
Yeah.
That's confusing.
I got a photo right here of Shran pouring a glass.
I was like, I remembered him sharing his liquor with in that kind of love-hate relationship they have.
Yeah. When's the Andorian ale cocktail book dropping?
Any day now.
Finalizing
art today.
Yeah, people can't see, but John's arms are stained blue up to the elbows from working on the Andorian ale recipe.
My teeth are just stained blue forever.
Yeah, I've been meaning to mention the whole time. It's disgusting, and I hate looking at it. Thank you so much for being on, and thank you for listening.
This was a pleasure.
Yeah, and thanks for listening to Temporal Culture War, and we'll see you soon. Bye, everybody.
Bye.